In the winter of 1795, a young Englishman named William Henry Ireland found this lost love poem from William Shakespeare to Anne Hathaway.
Is there in heaven aught more rare than thou, sweet nymph of Avon fair? Is there on earth a man more true than Willie Shakespeare is to you?
The letter captivated the literary set in London. Never before had a manuscript written in the bard's hand been found. And young William Henry Ireland kept finding more and more, including Shakespeare's lost 37th play. The problem was that William Henry Ireland was a fraud. The supposed works of Shakespeare were forgeries. Doug Stewart tells the story in his new book, The Boy Who Would Be Shakespeare, and he says William Henry did it to win the respect of his father, Samuel.
He wanted to impress his father, who was a rather pompous and emotionally chilly man. And his father was a collector and wanted more than anything to own something signed by Shakespeare.
So what happens? I mean, William Henry comes to his father with a piece of paper and says, I have found William Shakespeare's signature.
Right. He produced this deed that he wrote on a piece of old parchment using watered-down ink, so it looked old. But the father wasn't sure until a friend took a look at a wax seal that was part of this deed. And the friend said he could see in the seal a quinton, which is an object that a horseman would aim his lance at, practicing for a tournament. And the friend said, of course, this is something at which a horseman would shake his spear. And therefore, it must be an authentic deed because it had Shakespeare's personal emblem in the wax seal.
And now, as you described, Samuel Ireland was delighted to have this document authenticated. Before I ask you more about how William Henry, his son, went on to create this elaborate scheme, place this into context. What did people think about William Shakespeare in Britain at the end of the 18th century?
Well, just in the last few decades, there had been a sort of Shakespeare mania that had swept the British Isles. And this is something that wasn't true in Shakespeare's own lifetime, when he was a rather ordinary middle-class writer. But by the end of the 1700s, Shakespeare was considered the immortal bard. He was Exhibit A, proving that there was no genius like English genius. But if he was a deity, where were his holy relics?
Hmm.
And the fact that nothing from his life had turned up was very frustrating to Shakespeare's many admirers.
Of William Shakespeare's 37 plays, there is not one copy in his own writing. All of a sudden, this young man starts to come up with fragments of Shakespeare's writing. What was the backstory that William Henry was giving to his father? I mean, presumably his father and others were asking him, okay, where are you finding this material?
Right. He claimed he was finding it in an old oak trunk in the mansion of a wealthy gentleman friend who lived in London, who was insisting on anonymity. And it's important to understand that there had been sort of a nationwide manhunt to find these papers. So when the boy said, I found them, instead of being astounded, people's reaction was, oh, good, we were looking for those. It's about time.
William Henry Ireland started to become quite well known. He decides to collect these papers and publish them. And at that point, some serious doubt is cast on the authenticity.
Actually, it was his father who wanted to publish the papers. And this led to sort of the beginning of the end, because once the papers were printed, it gave everyone a chance to see engraved facsimiles of all these works in bright sunlight if they wanted to, and to really study them and see the quality of the work. For example, the poem to Anne Hathaway begins, Is there in heaven aught more rare than thou, sweet nymph of Avon fair? And it's sort of like roses are red, violets are blue. So, and there were people that, especially the people who really knew Shakespeare, who believed these things were forgeries from the start.
Now, of course, the culmination, or I guess not the culmination, but the kind of the apex of this ruse was when William Henry unearthed a lost Shakespeare play called Vortigern. And if you read it, I mean, there are passages that seem fairly plausible. Fortune, I thank thee, now is the cup of my ambition full, and so on and so forth. I mean, it goes on to the point where a theater in London decided to mount this production.
That's right. And the owner of the theater was not totally convinced by this play. He didn't think it was a forgery. He thought perhaps Shakespeare had been very young. But he did know there was a huge sensation surrounding it. And by booking this play in his theater and presenting it as the first premiere of a Shakespeare work in 200 years, he was counting on having a full house for night after night and week after week.
How did audiences react?
Well, it only lasted one night, I have to say. And historians later wrote that it was booed off the stage, which really is not true. It was a little bit like a Premier League soccer match in England, maybe, where you have camps that arrive to cheer one side or the other. Many people in attendance were there to denounce this play as a forgery. But many other people arrived believing they were witnessing a Shakespeare premiere.
Hmm. Doug Stewart, nobody definitively exposed these as fraudulent, but William Henry Ireland decided to confess. Why did he do that?
Well, when the boy finally confessed, if you read the confession, he's not contrite in the slightest. It's more of a boast. He's saying, I wrote these papers, me, these papers that have been praised by critics. And many people, seeing the confession, refused to believe him. They thought he was claiming credit for something that somebody else had done.
But he had thought that if I only confess, people will realize how talented I am as a playwright, and they'll sort of overlook that, and I'll get work doing other things.
Exactly. He thought he would be launched on a new career.
And that did not happen.
Right. In fact, his own father didn't believe the confession and continued to badger him about where he'd found the papers.
And whatever ended up happening to William Henry Ireland?
William Henry, as an adult, he lived another 35, 40 years. He wrote a string of Gothic novels, which were then very popular, and some of them sold well, and some of his own romantic poetry. Interesting thing is, once he wasn't in the straitjacket of trying to imitate Shakespeare and was able to write what he wanted, his writing tended to be terribly overwritten, real purple poetry, I guess.
That's Doug Stewart. He's the author of The Boy Who Would Be Shakespeare, A Tale of Forgery and Folly. Doug Stewart, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Guy.
Time now for a look back at the week in the news. And for that, we're joined by NPR senior news analyst Dan Schor. Dan, let's begin with the Gulf of Mexico spill. President Obama delivered a national address from the Oval Office for the first time to talk about it. What did you notice?
Well, what I notice is that he really wants to drive home that this is a serious matter. That's what Oval Office is supposed to denote. You do Oval Office, it really is very, very important. He'd made speeches before, apparently not managed to bring many people to his side, and so he took what for a president is the ultimate.
And then President Obama met this week with BP executives, and he got from them a commitment to put $20 billion in escrow
right.
to be a compensation fund. And overseeing the dispersal of that fund will be Kenneth Feinberg. He oversaw a similar fund for payouts to victims of 9/11. What do you think we should be on the lookout for in this agreement?
We should look out for whether Kenneth Feinberg is able to decide what he will compensate and what he will not compensate. I mean, he's going to have to decide whether a man who says, I would have earned these wages and I'm not getting these wages now. It is a very, very tricky thing that Ken Feinberg has been given to do now, and he'll be carefully watched as to how well he does it.
Mm-hmm. What's BP's interest, as you see it, in entering into this agreement?
Whatever measure of rehabilitation it manages to get out of this, I'm sure they're willing to take it. For them, to have someone else handle a compensation is probably also a mercy as far as they are concerned now. There are these difficult decisions to make as to who gets compensation for lost wages or not lost wages or fish not caught or fish that were caught and so on. That's not an easy thing to do. Ken Feinberg has a reputation there, and probably they were very easy about ceding this whole thing to Feinberg.
BP CEO Tony Hayward testified before Congress this week. You watched that testimony?
What's yes.
Your review.
Well, he made a very bad impression on Congress when he testified practically all day. I watched it practically all day. And for almost every question, it was, I wasn't there, I wasn't involved in that. You sort of wonder what he did in that company.
In terms of the news that was reported out of his appearance, what stood out almost as much as Mr. Hayward's testimony was a statement made by Joe Barton, Republican congressman from Texas.
Yes.
He referred to the compensation fund as a shakedown.
And he referred, yes.
He since apologized, but what's the political fallout been?
Well, the political fallout, he probably thought he was doing something for the oil companies, which has given him campaign contributions.
A major employer also in the Gulf.
And it is indeed a major employer. But he probably did them a lot more harm, at least in their eyes, than he did them any good. This is not exactly what they needed right now. And so he came back and tried to apologize a couple of times, but that little tag lingers.
Dan, let me take advantage of your historical perspective. Every president, Republican and Democratic, since Richard Nixon, who you covered 40 years ago, yes, has vowed that America had to break its dependence on oil.
Right.
So much has happened over the past 40 years. Why hasn't America become energy independent?
Because those who want dependence on oil have a lot of money to spend on lobbying, is why. It is very difficult to go up against an entrenched lobby of this sort. And much that they do try, it has not happened yet and may not very soon happen.
Let's move on to some foreign policy questions. General David Petraeus also testified before Congress this week.
Yes.
And he had delivered news that the planned offensive in Kandahar mm-hmm. is going to be delayed.
That's right. And he had to do that very carefully, because if he were to say that we don't think we can do it because things aren't going too well right there on the battlefield, that would be very bad. And also what would happen would be that President Karzai would begin to be tempted to try to make a deal with the Taliban, which the United States dearly does not want him to do, or at least doesn't want him to do unless the United States is also involved in it. But here they are. So what does the general say? He tries to emphasize that it's a very good thing to talk about this possible offensive in Kandahar and elsewhere, because it makes things seem urgent to them. Well, that's some reason for an offensive, but they are in terrible trouble, if not desperate trouble, in that area right now. And next December, when they get together and look at their policies again, I suspect there will be some changes.
New York Times reports this week that Afghanistan apparently has a wealth of mineral resources. They say maybe $1 trillion worth. What do you think the effect of the series of discoveries may be on Afghanistan?
Well,
over the next generation.
Over the next generation. What happened in Saudi Arabia when they found that they had oil, which people wanted to pay a lot of money for? You have resources. You have power, if the power is used right. If you allow a lot of foreigners in to exploit your power, then it doesn't quite work that way. But resources are power.
Thanks very much. NPR Senior News Analyst Dan Shore.
Sure thing.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. When a lot of people choose books to take with us in summer vacation, we often think of big, fat, juicy novels that we can soak up with the sun. Maybe our idea of summer reading is a little narrow. We asked several book reviewers about their picks for summer readings. They came up with an eclectic list that includes everything from thrillers to memoirs to poetry. NPR's Lynn Neary has the details.
Laura Miller, book reviewer for Salon, is something of a traditionalist when it comes to summer reading. She likes a book that takes her far away from reality.
Because we can't always afford to go on vacations, or maybe our vacations are just to stay with our family, which isn't always as much of a getaway as we might want. And so I like the kind of novel that carries you off to some far-off and very different place.
This year, Miller has been carried off by the novel Under Heaven. It's set in an imaginary version of Tang Dynasty China. As the book begins, the hero, the son of a famous general, is given a fabulously extravagant gift by a princess,
which is 250 of the most perfect horses, and it puts him right in the middle of this incredibly complex and dangerous political situation.
Filled with palace intrigue, fueled by a famously beautiful and cunning concubine, Miller says Under Heaven combines the best of historical and fantasy fiction. For John Freeman, editor of the literary magazine Granta, a pure historical novel has caught his attention this year, Parrot and Olivier in America, inspired by Alexis de Tocqueville's visit to our young democracy in the 19th century. Olivier, based on de Tocqueville, is a French aristocrat. Parrot, his servant and companion, is the son of an itinerant printer. Freeman says the two are a mismatched pair.
And the story is told in their two voices. They go back and forth, narrating the book forward, and you get different impressions of America and American democracy in it. And it's just brilliant, the storytelling and the voices that he's created for these characters, the way they argue with each other. It's quite a bit of fun.
Freeman says he likes to read big novels like this on the beach, but later, sitting on a porch or settling down for the night, he wants something different. He'll pull out a more slender volume, essays or even poetry.
I think poetry is like cocktail hour. It comes every day at a certain time, you know, and you look forward to it, at least I do, because it's in some ways it brings the sense of ritual back to language.
This summer, Freeman is taking U.S. Poet Laureate Kay Ryan's collection, The Best of It, on his travels. He says her poems aren't fussy or fancy, and they contain some hard truths.
But when you read that in this voice, this sort of well-carpentered, deeply intelligent, plain-spoken American voice, it's somehow soothing.
And with that, Freeman takes out his copy of the book and reads one of Ryan's poems.
There's a short poem called Emptiness, which I really love. It goes, "Emptiness cannot be compressed, nor can it fight abuse. Nor is there an endless west hosting elk, antelope, and the tough cayuse. This is true also of the mind. It can get used."
But if poetry seems an odd choice for summer reading to some, how about a book by the famously acerbic author Christopher Hitchens?
You don't like a good sort of beach blanket indictment of Henry Kissinger?
Troy Patterson, who reviews for Slate, says in his memoir, Hitch 22, Christopher Hitchens is more chatty than catty, as if he were relaxing in an armchair, not standing at a lectern.
This feels less like what we've come to think of as a memoir than just sort of a great raconteur telling stories about his own life.
Patterson says some of the best stories are about Hitchens' friendships with well-known writers like Salman Rushdie and Martin Amis, story Hitchens talked about on this program. And as a companion to this book, Patterson recommends Amis's new novel, The Pregnant Widow, a coming-of-age story set in the 1970s about a character named Keith Nearing.
He's British. He's 20. He's spending the summer in Italy with his girlfriend, Lily, and her friend, Scheherazade. And this will prove to be an erotically decisive summer for Keith.
Patterson, who says he's more of a hammock reader than a beach reader, believes Amis is the best prose stylist in the English language today. So he loves the extra time that summer gives him to linger over the words. But if you prefer the kind of book that makes your pulse race, then you may have noticed a genre that's missing from this list, a genre that Laura Miller says is a must on any summer reading list.
You have to have your international thriller where the people travel to exotic places. This is Michael Gruber's The Good Son, which is that rare thriller that when you read it, you don't sort of feel like you just ate like an entire bag of potato chips.
The Good Son, says Miller, is a smart thriller about a U.S. Special Forces soldier raised in Pakistan whose mother gets kidnapped in Afghanistan. It has lots of action and suspense, but is also a thought-provoking look at the differences between modern Western culture and a tribal way of life. Miller says Gruber is one of the best thriller writers around.
Anyone who's ever read a Michael Gruber novel will sort of buttonhole you and pull you aside and say, you have to read this guy. You have to read him. He's so great because he's such a wonderful writer and he's such a great plotter. And those two things are so rarely found.
So it doesn't really matter if you choose a big, fat, juicy novel or a slim volume of poetry, a memoir or a thriller. The point is, it's summer, a great excuse to read whenever and whatever you want. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And you can read excerpts from all these critics' picks on our website. Search for the Summer Books Package, where you'll find a lot more recommendations for everything from cookbooks to crime fiction. Go to npr.org/summerbooks. Even before the oil spill, many Gulf Coast families were living near the financial edge, their savings depleted by Hurricane Katrina. For those who fish for a living, the disaster has cut off both their source of income and a major source of food, NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
At St. Anthony's Church in Lafitte, Louisiana, people started lining up at 4 in the morning, even though the doors weren't set to open until 9. They were there for free food, actually $100 grocery gift cards.
You think we'd be sitting in these lines for 5 hours for $100 in food? If we didn't need it, none of us would be here.
Diane Poche is 61 years old, and up until a month ago, she worked with her husband. He's a commercial fisherman, has been all his life. But now they can't fish, and Poche says they're forced to rely on the BP claims process for their entire income.
I don't have any money coming in my house, period. My June bills have been due and past due now. It don't look like BP cares about our June bills.
So she brought a lawn chair and lined up early. Poche is sitting with a group of women who all seem to know each other. They're well put together, and you could easily imagine them sitting on the sidelines at a kid's soccer game. But instead, they're in the church cafeteria waiting for a handout. Steve Linehan is with Catholic Charities of New Orleans, the group coordinating the giveaway.
They're not used to getting help, assistance. They're usually self-sufficient, but this is a new situation for them and something that is just frustrating for them.
Catholic Charities has set up 5 community assistance centers in southern Louisiana to deal with the fallout of the spill. They're funded in part by a $1 million grant from BP. Company spokesman Curtis Thomas says it's a safety net.
And if they need immediate assistance and they need groceries for today, you know, and if the claim process doesn't work for them for some reason, either they don't have the paperwork or they haven't gotten a number yet, please come down and get a voucher from Catholic Charities. They are in place so that people do have emergency assistance.
The BP grant ran out last week and hasn't yet been renewed. But Catholic Charities is still giving away food cards, offering counseling services and paying up to $200 towards one bill. Linehan says they've helped nearly 10,000 people since May 1st. But every time they give out food cards, once a week at each site, they run out and have to turn people away.
Well, we have limited resources. Unfortunately, we can't help everybody. But they can come back again next week and reapply.
He says the demand just keeps growing. Rod Thomasy is holding a piece of paper with the number 77 on it, indicating his place in line.
They only give him 75 out. Now, if I get lucky, I don't know.
Thomasy has 3 kids to feed. He used to bring Gulf Seafood home from his job as a deckhand, but because of the spill, he hasn't worked in 7 weeks.
They tell a child that, you know, you don't have no food. I don't have no work. Last week, they turned around, they cut my lights off, my water. I haven't had any work. It's a good thing for these people here, and my mom and my dad. They turned around and fork up a few dollars to help me put my lights and water back on.
Thomasy did luck out. He got a grocery card, but he says he really just wants to get back to work. He dropped out of high school to start working on a boat. Fishing is all he knows, and the oil spill has taken that away, at least for now. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The Blues Brothers is now officially not just a wild comic romp, but a spiritual touchstone. The Vatican newspaper, Osservatore Romano, says that the film, which was released 30 years ago this weekend, now joins The Passion of Christ and the Ten Commandments as recommended viewing for Catholics everywhere. You might recall that the Blues Brothers, played by John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, say they're on a mission from God to save the Catholic orphanage in Chicago, where they grew up. Dan Aykroyd told the New York Post, as a former altar boy from age 6, but a somewhat lapsed Catholic, I was delighted with the endorsement. My local Monsignor will immediately be receiving a check for parish needs.
Got what I got the hard way. I don't make better each and every day. So honey, don't you fret, 'cause you ain't seen nothing yet. I'm a soul.
You're listening to NPR News.